CIS, not to be confused with CSI, Communication Society. And the next big stage that we're taking in terms of this particular module is that that is intimately connected with the P word, printing, and the printing press. And over the next 40 or so minutes, I'll be introducing you to such concepts as monk pages, and a system of actually gathering how many pages a monk can actually usefully do per day. This is based on the premise that prior to the advent of the printing press, the way in which literary media was circulated through society was done by monks primarily laboriously copying out page after page. And on average, they do about a page a day. Okay, so we'll see how that actually changes and adjusts within this whole essence of the impact of printing. And as impact would suggest, clearly it's something which arguably society is still recovering from, something like 700 or 800 years later. Whether we're shifting into other revolutions, of course, we'll see in this particular module. But as far as this is concerned, one of the key academics that has done or did a major study, she passed away a couple of years ago, into the whole essence of printing as an agent of change, and she deliberately uses this term, agent of change, is Elizabeth Eisenstein. Not to be confused with the Russian filmmaker of the same name, who gave the cinema, amongst other things, Montage. His name is Sergei Eisenstein. Not to be confused, obviously, with the friend Meerkat of Alexander, who's also called Sergei. Actually, you won't be familiar with the meerkats in Carolina, I just realised that. Use YouTube whilst you're here and type in meerkats, comparethemeerkats.com. Probably be a whole new experience. Anyway, Eisenstein was somebody who very much felt that too little academic focus had been provided for this phenomenon of print. We take it for granted, certainly those of us who are literate take it for granted, whether you're looking at brochures, whether you're looking at printed off, you know, we're kind of used to print. It's there, it's ubiquitous. It's pretty much everywhere we look, you can actually access print and so on. Admittedly, you might say, oh yes, but newspapers aren't as popular as they used to be, but nevertheless, they're still there, they're still very much easily available, likewise in terms of leaflets, in terms of textbooks, in terms of books in general. Print is clearly something which has changed the way that we deal with society. And as far as communications and public relations is concerned, it's that essence of change that is at the heart of what we refer to when we start talking about print in every sense of the word. I mean, from this point of view, we're clearly looking at the Western European culture, but you could say the same thing in terms of China, Asia, and so on. It certainly has an impact in a number of ways, some of which we've already spoken about, some of which are fairly obvious, some of which are fairly clear. Others maybe give you another little insight in terms of how things operate. And if I was to say that if you go back to the establishment of the early printing press, it would probably be in a room maybe twice the size of this one that the first major printing presses were established. So not a huge amount of space needed. But actually the impact in terms of actually putting in a printing press, as was developed by Gutenberg, as I say, has huge ramifications in terms of the way in which information is disseminated amongst society and so on. So those are some of the things that Elizabeth Eisenstein would maintain actually relates to printing. It's not as many ideas as obviously we put forward for Walter Ong last week in 3000, but actually in terms of the impact, you've got a fair number of key things there. The rebirth, translation of Renaissance, the rebirth of culture. The Reformation, the first Brexit, some might say, the way in which Henry VIII effectively obviously used print, and Luther in particular, nailed his changes for religion to various church doors and so on. You could say that without printing, no modern capitalism whatsoever. the whole essence of buying things for money and having a workforce who would be trained in terms of producing elements and doing a variety of other things probably would not exist without print being in place. Well, you might say in terms of politics, we'd probably be better off without that, but actually, probably would say we couldn't really function as a democracy if we didn't have some way of relating to what sort of things our political elected leaders are arguing for or wish to actually put into practice. We hear a great deal at elections about manifestos, about things that are actually promised by folk, and obviously holding politicians to account very much slots into place with respect to that. There's an interesting one, though. Western European exploration. How do you think printing has kind of impacted on that, given that arguably it was the Vikings who first discovered North America, or found it was there? Something beginning with M and ending in P. Yeah, absolutely. If you can actually print maps, have guidelines put together, that clearly impacts in terms of being able to travel to different places, maybe travel to the Americas, north and south, maybe travel to the East Indies. All of these things kind of impact in terms of Western European exploration. And was anybody here never read a bedtime story by their parents as a child? You all remember actually having a bedtime story. Thank goodness, if somebody was turning around and saying, I never had a bedtime story read to me, I was a robot. Good. But even on that one, the reading of a story, it's a social bonding aspect. It's the way in which we kind of connect on that basis. Water cooler moments, things that we have shared in common, things that we kind of can relate to, texts that we've put together. You know, the gift of literacy, universal literacy. Being able to write things down in a language that we know, assuming it's not mistranslated, can effectively communicate the messages that we want to give out to other people in all sorts of ways. And without literacy, without that notion of scientists not being able to say, well, the moon was in the wrong phase, or the spirits weren't right, or the vegetables weren't in the right order, you'd have no scientific method. You would be basically saying that the coronavirus was the will of the gods and we're all doomed. Oh no! As opposed to sensibly thinking about, okay, how can we deal with this? How can we approach it? How can we address this topic? How can we develop cures? And so on and so forth. This whole essence of the scientific method would not be able to function at all without print being in place. Okay, so some of the key elements that come across when we start talking about print. And there you see you have a gentleman who could be very much the model of a printer. The end of the 15th century, early 16th century, whether it's Thomas Caxton printing his British versions of the Bibles, etc., or whether it's the notion of Johannes Gutenberg, who, as I said, had a number of attempts at making money. He tried to actually sell medicines, fake medicines, etc. That didn't work. He had various. Finally, he came across this sort of thing, this strange device that he thought would be a way of actually ensuring that you could mass print things. It's a very straightforward thing. You have printing presses. Fundamentally, that design pretty much has stayed the same. It's got bigger, obviously, but it's stayed pretty much the same over the last 500 to 600 years. You know, that's the kind of way that it actually is. And it's a relatively straightforward thing. You literally get your type set, face set, and then you print it on from there. The big shift, of course, was desktop publishing, which, again, we'll talk on that in terms of how the rise of computing impacts as well as far as printing is actually concerned. So effectively, you've got your paper there, you've got your printer there, print it out, put it down, and the paper comes out there. If you allow for the fact that one monk would produce one handwritten page per day, one Gutenberg, if you use that line, i.e. Gutenberg printing press, would produce the same amount, it basically would do 200 monks' work. 200 monk days would be the equivalent to one Gutenberg in terms of how it was being developed. So already you've got the possibility, rather than actually saying, I'd like to actually produce 100 odd flyers, no, that's going to take at least 3 months. You've got a chance to actually put that out there and mass produce the thing, so you can get your message out there more significantly. Just moving up, and I'll give you copies from this point of view. I'm curious enough, actually in print. Wow. In fact, I'll share that now, just to work out through this. Never let it be said that I don't actually select audiovisual aids that physically actually sort of provide a sort of generic sort of thing as well. I think this should be fine. So as you can see, if you just look at the sort of thing there, and this actually comes from Revolutions in Communication by Corvick, which is a good text to look at from that point of view. One Gutenberg will give you 200 monk days. One Walter, which is the inventor of the steam press, that comes about in the 17th century, 12,000 monk days. So effectively, to actually produce the same sort of thing, you'd have to have 12,000 monks laboriously working for one day, or one monk doing 12,000 days working through that. You come up to the Pulitzer Prize-winning thing, a million monk days, optical typesetting, and so on and so forth. You can actually see the way in which the speed has improved rapidly since this onset of print first came through. Time taken to actually photocopy this morning? 20 seconds. Just imagine if I'd been a monk. Copy out everything, yeah. Still be doing it now. You know? And then times five, so it might have been ready for the end of Friday, okay? Again, speed very much of the essence there. Now that's a good thing. There's reasons why you're going to say it possibly could be challenging as well, but it all ties into that. Now, Elizabeth, that is not Elizabeth, by the way, just in case you're wondering, it's just Miss Happy, not Mystical, etc. She's a bit unhappy because, as she said, she doesn't really maintain, or didn't, that scholars actually acknowledge print for the wondrous and marvellous thing it actually is. And she'd say it was basically a case that they talk about the desktop publishing revolution. They would talk about the onset of computers and IT, etc. Though, in other words, you'd look solely at the technology as opposed to print itself. And print and what was being said was often treated as, if anything, kind of incidental. It's almost there. It becomes almost, because it's ever-present, we almost don't notice it, a bit like oxygen. You know, it's there as a matter of course. I mean, again, we asked the question a couple of weeks ago, imagine a world where you actually took out all of the communication-oriented stores in any particular city centre and you'd have a challenge from that point of view. So I think key things that she was raising at from that point of view. And there, of course, is one of the reasons why she said this was how print was really impacting on things. We talked about this again a couple of weeks ago. What does that image represent?
Doctors?
A doctor, absolutely. Not a doctor that you'd probably see in ER or St. Elsewhere or indeed Holby City or anything else in that void, but clearly a doctor who is effectively channeling the whole notion and dealing with the plague of a nosegay at the end of the beak and hoping that effectively they've got the ability to, you know, cure people and so on and so forth. But they're working very much in a whole dark area. They don't have any kind of indication of how do they cope with these viruses, these problems, these issues. How do we actually work with that? And whether it's a case of fleas hitching rides on the backs of rats and therefore spreading bubonic plague, causing huge mass deaths, etc. Whether it's a case of poor hygiene, whether it's a combination of all of these kind of things, you're coming into the problems of the 1300s. And as we said, the Dark Ages, like that. Oh no! I mean, again, it's not a case of we're looking back from a perspective of where we are now, and who knows, maybe we're living in our own particular Dark Ages. But if you look at the visual images of the time, you look at the kind of popular cultural aspects that were being formed. This was very much seen as the end of days. It was a day, it was a time where effectively, you know, this veil of tears, this existence, this tragedy that we spent a few years on Earth, etc., at the behest of the Almighty, etc., and powers beyond our control. You'd have death, you'd have despair, you'd have annihilation, you'd have the apocalypse. And of course, you could cynically turn around and say, this is all being encouraged by the doctrinal leaders of the time, specifically the church and the state, because it keeps the status quo going. You know, if doctors can only have a particular area or indeed a particular area of expertise that they specialise in, then that knowledge generates power with it as well. One of the things about print is it can democratise a knowledge. Everybody can actually learn about things, as opposed to it just being the preserve of one or two individuals. You know, if you were a literate monk, you had a position of power because you were the only person who effectively could read and understand and translate the scriptures or other sort of aspects. If you go back to one of the key things that very much, I think probably in Britain, we don't kind of appreciate, the Magna Carta. You know, that document, you know, basically, if you look at the signature, even King John at the time, it was basically just an X, you know, that he signed it with, you know, in terms of the sort of key things there, the sort of appreciation of reading and writing, the power of that. Sometimes, again, we kind of forget from that point of view. And, of course, the Dark Ages that we work through from that point of view as well. So what are some of the preconditions for print that Eisenstein would actually talk about? What are some of the key areas of things that she would say are essential for print to emerge and work through? Well, maybe the first one is blindingly obvious. If you can't read, it's just squiggles on a page. You need to have people who are able to mentally translate those squiggles into words. In other words, it's a literate laity. The laity actually referring to the general population, the area from that. Literate is obviously come from literature, etc. The reading of that. If you are illiterate, if you're unable to read, and probably the best example is, again, think what it's like. Go abroad, overseas, to a country like China, like Turkey, etc. And there's no English, and you just, you know, you have no experience of what those signs might mean. Challenging times from that point of view. Probably it's easy to think of it from that perspective as opposed to trying to remember what it was like when you couldn't read. Although maybe, you know, we probably can remember just about the sort of key things from that. You also need money. Gutenberg would have got nowhere if people hadn't invested in his machinery. One of the reasons for the growth of newspapers was that people wanted information. The rise of the middle class in the 17th and 18th century and 19th century, the expanding trading routes that were happening in Britain and in other countries, necessitated knowing what things were happening in the countries that these goods were being exported to. And indeed, which countries needed which goods. Which countries might have been at war. Which countries were different trade routes. And all of that comes at a price in terms of how you're going to actually develop it. So capital and actually having some sort of system by which you can afford the sort of printing is very important. Actually, the third one that Eisenstein talks about is quite an interesting thing because China, as I said, had kind of formulated a version of the printing press. But it never quite took off. Mainly, some have argued, because it's more of a pictorial, image-based language. It's easier to actually sort of, you know, with your dashes and various other things when you're writing Mandarin, to have that. But there is a suggestion that if Marco Polo had gone to China and had seen a printing press that's actually working, then maybe there would have been a completely different shift in terms of how we're seeing that as well. So it's still seen as a precondition, certainly for Western prints to take place. And you need other crafts and industries. Why? So they can advertise. So if you are, I mean, one of the things that I always find quite fascinating is the reasons why barbers, for instance, or hairdressers had a sort of red and white striped pole on them. It's because they used to be butchers. It's because it basically was a way of actually sort of blood and various other bits and pieces there. It was a signifier and they did the hair as a matter of course. But it's you go through some of the old towns and the kind of things, whether it's the pauper's balls, whether it's sort of the mortar and pestle of a chemist. You know, in a pre-literate age, the only way people knew roughly what stores were selling, whether that be a chemist or a pharmacist or a drugstore, whether it be a greengrocer's, whether it be a butcher's, whether it be a hairdresser, was by the symbols that they put outside. You know, that's the reason why I say pharmacists over the years, you'd have a mortar and pestle to indicate that they knew how to actually make ingredients and stuff up from that point of view. So you'd have all of those sort of put into place. Now, if you can also then advertise, I mean, are you going to use this as an example? You're welcome to Edinburgh, guide the Royal Yacht Britannia, step aboard the Queen's former floating palace and explore Britannia's five decks, from the state apartments to the cruise quarters, 10% off. You know, it's a fly, it's produced to obviously encourage tourism and a variety of other bits and pieces as well. Tesco, fantastic offers. You know, a lot of print is used to sell things. You know, number of sort of times you're actually like, why do they put in so many flyers in magazines, etc.? You know, it's like pop-up ads, same sort of thing, they're constantly there, they want to get messages out there. And that also ties in with the second point there, obviously capital, but the reason I put the literate laity at the top is, if you can't read, it's pointless. And again, fairly straightforward. If you are using printing presses, you need to have paper to print. And hopefully you'll be offsetting your carbon footprint by printing trees as well, planting trees and so on. But you still need to have, you know, paper as the resource to work through as well. So let's consider this next one there. And I've incorporated the image of the printing press there to ask the question, and I'll talk about it rhetorically now, and we'll talk more in detail in the session on Thursday. What were the effects of printing on people's lives? Because, you know, obviously people were living, breathing, doing the sort of stuff that they were doing, getting out dawn to dusk, etc. And certainly one of the key things that we are slaves to now, and maybe people say, why, is the timetable. Prior to the 1700s, if we were having this session, we'd say, well, we'll probably gather about sort of maybe mid-afternoon, then we may stop basically when the sun goes down, and various other bits. Yeah, there wouldn't be a specific time. The reason timetables became so ubiquitous and so essential, down to one thing and one thing only, and that's the rise of the railways. If railways are mass transiting people, you need to know roughly, or fairly accurately actually, when the trains are going to be in certain particular areas. Otherwise, what's the point? I appreciate you might say, well, in Lincoln, we turn up, we may get a train in the next 3 days, we may not, I don't know. But saying that the reason there is very much, it's a kind of driving force in terms of how we see how timetables are put into place, etc. But that's one. So there's some of them, basically according to Eisenstein. How does print impact on knowledge? Suddenly there's a lot more of it. How do we know this? Well, orality, we've already talked about at length. And orality, effectively, you are at the mercy of your memory and possibly one or two other people's memories as well. It's how much can you remember? And then all the things that go along with that, Chinese whispers and so on, how much do you forget, evanescence, all the sort of areas within that. Whereas actually, with respect to printing, I don't have to remember that one Wozniak, after Steve Wozniak, one of the founders of desktop publishing, is equal to 12 megamonks, because printed out, it's there. You know, you can actually have much, much more knowledge that's actually there. So knowledge, in a sense, increases massively. Also, we start beginning to sift through what is entertaining knowledge, amusing knowledge, dangerous knowledge, useful knowledge, etc. So we can disseminate. That's where seminars come from, dissemination. You can actually break things down into individual aspects. Thirdly, you can teach yourself. Perhaps it's not as much fun, but you can still do that. You can actually improve yourself. You can learn more. You can do research into particular areas that you're interested in. You can find out about the companies you want to work for, the areas you want to take part in, the illnesses you might be suffering from, etc., etc., etc. And in an ideal world, you get certain standards put in place. So in the case of higher education, for instance, you know, there's a big shape about where are we in terms of universities. Actually, there's about 2 or 3 percentage difference between universities that are at the top of the tree, Oxbridge, etc., the sort of middle range, mid to upper ones like ourselves at Lincoln, the bottom end of the tree, newbies, etc. But broadly speaking, the quality and the quantity of the standardisation, and also in terms of knowing that, you know, measuring out a gallon in Newcastle will be the same as a gallon in Bristol, or things are going to be consistent. There's going to be a certain standardisation put together for that. Many folk, anarchists in particular, not that I'm necessarily against anarchy, but it is an interesting point, would say it enables a lot more data to be collected. The first census in Britain was pretty much carried out by the Normans, because once they conquered the country, back in 1066, they want to know what the hell they got. So effectively, you know, they specifically, you know, introduced this whole notion of census taking, finding out how many people were there, how many people needed to be done, and that's one of the reasons why there are censuses, or censuses are taken, you know, roughly any 10 years to get an indication in terms of, you know, who is actually in the country, etc. But also data collection in terms of things like climate change, in terms of things like medical issues, in terms of experiments, in terms of finding out how things are being developed, and from data collection into classification, into organisation. So you can narrow things down there. Taxonomies used to be very popular. It was in the natural sciences where you'd actually sort of, you literally sort out different species, different phyla, you kind of classify people and individuals. Data fixing, Cambridge Analytica. You can also sort of manipulate data. You can corrupt data. Statistics can be used rather like a lamppost for support or illumination. It's one of the reasons why there's a phrase saying there are lies, damned lies, and statistics. Data can be false. But either way, you can also increase the noise that's being made. You can amplify it. You know, if you've got facts and data to back up the things, as we said, in terms of, you know, if you look at one Berners-Lee, named after Tim Berners-Lee, dear Lord, you need 1.3 million megabunks to, or million monks to actually work through that. More monks than we can actually find. Monkeys. Nobody remembers the Monkees, do they? 1960s band. Very good. Two of them dead now, but still never mind. British American answer to the Beatles. Look at the Monkees, spelled M-O-N-K-E-E-S. On YouTube, whole series of them. Anybody know the Monkees? Some do, some don't. Yasmin, you don't know the Monkees?
I don't know.
Unbelievable. Well, what a treat you got in store when you got your Yasmin on your Yasmin tube, though, on your YouTube. Sorry, sure. Good. Okay. One of the shifts. And some might say we're going back to images with things like emojis and so on now. But there is, as Eisenstein would say, a gradual move from what effectively was all images. I talked about that in terms of shopkeeper signs and signs of commerce, etc., to a print-based culture. You know, those shapes and ways in which the thing that we're seeing on screen now, we can translate as from image to print culture, ? Because we're culturally familiar with that. How would I kind of rephrase that if I was actually just looking at sort of other sort of questions that, well, again, different sort of issue, different sort of technique. So, there's an image. What is that image sharing with us?
Looks like North America, Mexico, South America too.
Yeah, absolutely. The Nova Orbis, the new world, new description in the Americas. It looks like, but I wouldn't want to actually rely on that particular map to actually get me there safely around the whole thing. I mean, yeah, it's roughly the same, but there's a heck of a sort of changes in terms of where you're going. And it's one of the reasons why actually circumnavigating the globe, going round the Americas, etc., is so fraught with danger. Because you didn't know where the weather conditions were going to be bad, you didn't know where the climate was going to be challenging, where there were rocks that you were easily going to be sort of brought onto, and so on and so forth. So you kind of want to, it's one of the reasons why 250 years ago, actually 251 years ago, James Cook left Whitby, because he'd had enough with the Northeast, and so that's it, I'm off, and started the first of three major mapping expeditions, one to Australia, one to Canada, and the other one to Hawaii. And lines from that point of view were the third one, of course, because apparently the natives thought, he's come back again, they killed him. Again, confusion, but never mind. So, you know, that whole essence of getting an understanding of our world, you know, it's relatively recent, i.e. over the last three or four centuries, that we've really been able to map out the world. And certainly it's only in your parents' lifetime that we've ever from space actually seen the blue, green marble that is the globe that kind of gets us thinking about climate and various other bits and pieces. But equally, when you start seeing things like that in terms of medical texts, etc., like, whoa, what is this? You know, it's all sorts of very difficult, very, and again, it's partly due to even in print, awful lot of the printing is very tiny, very neat, because it's costing things to produce. They can't just churn out a whole range of things there. You've got to kind of fit certain things into pages. If you look at some of the early newspapers of the 1700s and 1800s, they are jam-packed, literally, up to the line, with teeny tiny writing. It's almost as much possible things like a micro dot that's actually in there. It's not because they didn't have any designers, it's just because actually they wanted to pack in as much information into that sheet as they possibly could. And again, it's another area in terms of, you think about how do you use space, how do you actually get messages put across within that whole sort of space within that. There are four images. Has anybody got any idea in terms of what those images are particularly useful for? Who, if you were a scholar at university in the 1600s, you might sort of think, ah, yes, that's what they're studying.
It's in medicine.
Yeah. How do you know that? Can you be a bit more precise?
Because of the band wrap that looks like looking for veins.
It's taking blood pressure. It's taking veins. Early way of actually sort of getting a sense in terms of where the veins are, how things are going, developing, etc. I mean, you know, medicine itself has kind of developed hugely over the premise of, you know, Burke and Hare, grave robbers, providing cadavers for students at Edinburgh to chop up and into bits and find out what bits were here and there, etc. Well, a very messy and somewhat harsh history, but at the same time, it's the ways in which we come to understand how the human body functions, how it works, etc. And yet, actually, very few, in fact, virtually no indication there of print. It's all visual. So the key thing actually being that don't necessarily think that print culture is just to do with letters on a page and various other things. It can also include the printing of images too. And remember the statement that a picture is worth a thousand words. Sometimes that's all you need. You think of the most effective advertising campaigns, you think of the most effective slogans, etc. And it is just a short, sharp image and package that you get with respect to that. So, talking about some of the other effects on society. Well, in my top 10 there, or Annie Eisenstein's top 10 that she's put together, an expanded education, well, at least it means that you haven't had to go to work when you're 14 and leave your college to basically support the family. So that's good, perhaps. And it's meant that actually education, maybe for a select few, maybe the top 20, 30, 40%, has kind of become something which is more than just a privilege, but something that you can actually engage in and find out more and reflect upon life, etc. Maybe as we've become more sceptical, more scientific, maybe we've also become increasingly secular. You know, the notion about where do we maintain the position of the church? You know, what are our views with respect to particular religious beliefs? And I'm not asking, but it is an undeniable fact that Britain, for instance, which was once hailed as being a very Christian-based country, I don't know, maybe 40-45%, I mean, I classify myself amongst them, but there is a sort of shift to secular sort of aspect within that. We've already talked about the growth of capitalism, not just the, and of course it's antithesis communism, as written about by Karl Marx, written about by Karl Marx, printed by Karl Marx and Hegel. Without a print, there's no way you could have had that counter argument to capitalism put forward. Some might say it's a good thing, some might say it's a bad thing as well. And equally, you get the emergence of mass media. We look in subsequent weeks at radio, we look at television, we look at cinema, we look at new technologies. Obviously, Jason did that a couple of weeks ago. But you're looking at this mass media that has a bedrock of prints to develop, etc. More and more people are actually literate. You still have few folk who aren't, and there's a line from that point of view. Bourgeoisie. That's a very fancy name. What do we mean by the bourgeoisie? Oh, that's so bourgeois. What does it actually refer to?
The rich, or the people who own the factories and stuff like that.
Yeah, the owners, the folk who effectively sort of will effectively maintain that they're in charge versus the peasants and so on, the way in which that's there. And it can be a very delicate balance. You know, you could say that Meghan and Harry are part of the bourgeoisie. They don't really want to be part of the royal family, but they're quite happy to actually sort of do their own sort of, anyway, so they'll buy the buy in terms of that. But yes, the bourgeoisie there, rich, etc. Politicisation, we've spoken about. The seventh one, or the eighth one down there, is quite an interesting one, quite a frightening one as well. National identity. Why is that potentially quite frightening? The rise of nationalism, which kind of emerged in the 1500s and sadly still kind of has its tentacles in its in the human species even today, where we kind of will go to war over a sod of earth and say, that's ours. No, it's not. It's yours. How are we getting your own land? I don't know. That whole notion of national sovereignty, the difference between the Welsh, the Scots, the Irish, the French, the Europes, the other, etc., etc., all of the sort of issues that come into that, kind of relates to that. And you look at some of the sort of histories of the ways in which different cultures have kind of related to that loss of national identity, or relation to national identity, can be very shocking in all sorts of ways from that point of view. Which again, individualism. Well, we can all hopefully look to divine our own selves by the kind of things that we read. As I said, probably the last person who had an authentic understanding of everything probably lived in the 1500s, Francis Bacon, or maybe Erasmus. There's too much now. There's no way that everybody in this room can actually understand everything about hip-hop music and everything about sporting activities and everything about deoxyribonucleic acid. And, you know, the more you learn, the more you realise, the less you know. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there. You have to be selective. You have to, in a sense, make your own path to actually determine what things you're looking for, etc. That probably leads into the whole essence of a new consciousness. Actually being able to deal with things, change things, because you can apply the knowledge that you're learning and developing alongside the whole system. All of which come out of print. And there are four people who, if you took print out of the equation, would be lost. They would not have been able to get their ideas out there. Galileo Galilei had probably just been excommunicated by the Catholic Church, and his views on gravity or his development of that wouldn't have worked at all, or his sense about that. Johannes Kepler, who did an awful lot of observations in terms of the movement of the planets and so on, so did Nicholas Copernicus. And Isaac Newton, of this very area, because he was born basically about 30 or so miles away, and we have a building named after him now, there's no way he could have written his Principia Mathematica. Newton's Principia Mathematica was often regarded as like the fundamental sort of appreciation of mathematics as a language, as a line within that whole field. He actually spent the rest of his life pretty much defending it. But again, without Newton's work and the print knowledge coming into place within that, none of the people that we kind of, I mean, maybe you don't know or didn't know all four, maybe did, but you know, they're kind of fundamental in terms of where we are today in terms of our world, etc. And again, the apple on Newton's head, look, it's how we know it's apple, because it looks like an apple. The Copernican model of the universe, or at least the solar system, with the planets actually revolving around the sun and the moon revolving around the earth. Huge paradigm shift. By paradigm shift, I mean change in the way that people think. And when you bear in mind that you spent your entire life maintaining that the sun actually revolved around the earth, because it goes like that, obviously, And yet, actually, it's completely reverse of that. It's the Earth spinning around. We are spinning around at such a phenomenal rate that if it wasn't for centripetal force and centrifugal force holding us down, we'd fly off now. Hold on tight, everybody. A lot of stuff that's actually there which gives us an understanding. And you might still say, well, we never landed on the moon. But actually, the fact that you can use this science to actually effectively put up geosynchronous satellites, to actually deal with inter-solar system travel, and so on and so forth, is fairly critical in terms of how the significance of these people kind of come into place as well. As we said, secularity, mass media, widespread national identity, and so on. And there's a gentleman who, as I said, sort of 17th century, so 1561 through to 1626, probably one of the last of the individuals you'd say possibly knew most things about most things before so much print started magnifying in terms of what was happening and what was taking place as far as life was concerned as well.